You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up, 2021 saw a significant drop in bankruptcy filings. We'll find out what impact that had on the economy. Now, our next guest has skied in every single American Birkebeiner ski race. That's right. At the age of 74, Ernie St. Germain has never missed the annual cross-country ski race in northern Wisconsin since it started in 1973. The Birkebeiner is the largest North American ski race. Ernie is considered one of its founders. Ernie, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Well, thank you. Thank you for inviting me.
Could you take us back to 1973? Tell us a little bit about the origins of the race and how you got into it.
Well, the community around Hayward, there were a lot of Norwegians. There's a lot of real strong culture here of many Norwegians. And, of course, Tony Wise, who had Telmark and Historyland and log rolling and started many things in Hayward, invited a skier from Norway to come over in 1972 and start developing ski trails. And he did. And the very next year, in order to keep promoting Nordic skiing, because he had an alpine downhill ski area to promote Nordic skiing, they decided they would do a race that is fashioned after the Norwegian Birkebeiner in Norway. And that race, they ski from one town over a mountain to the next town, and that's 55 kilometers. And then the next year, they ski back in the other direction. And so each year, they ski back and forth. And so Tony decided, well, we can do that. We can, we don't have a mountain, but we have some amazing hills between Telmark Lodge up in Cable and Hayward. And so he decided to have this race and got the word out. And I'm not one of those old Norwegians, wanted to do the race himself, and his wife says, absolutely not. You're 72 years old, and you are not going to ski that race. And his name was Lyman Williamson. And he looked at me, and he said, my boy, Edna won't let me ski it, so you're going to have to represent me. And I said, sure, nothing to it. I had no idea what I was getting into.
You did it the first race. Did you think that was it?
I swore up and down I would never do anything so foolish ever.
What did you feel like after you completed it for the first time?
I was in good shape. I was an athlete. My body was fine. The only thing that wasn't were the balls of my feet. And, you know, your heel is not attached in a Nordic binding. So your foot flexes at the toes and the ball of the foot as you stride on the skis. And my feet were just not prepared for that. And my body did fine, but the balls of my feet, oh my goodness. I had to crawl for 3 days. I had a hard time walking.
All right, now hang on, Ernie. You were a proxy for a 72-year-old, you just said. You're 74, and you're still skiing the Berkey, including this year. Now, how do you feel after doing that at 74?
You know, when I was 72 years old skiing the race, I thought of Lyman just almost every K. I thought of him, and every year I thank him for, you know, telling me I had to represent him. That night, Tony Wise had an awards banquet at that first year up at Telmark. And I came back to the house, to Lyman's house, and sat down on the couch and then slowly laid down on the couch and fell asleep. And about 6 o'clock, he came and woke me up and he said, come on, my boy, we have to go up to the awards banquet. And I looked at him and I said, Lyman, you're going to have to represent me. But Tony Wise was an entrepreneur and he was just an amazing person. He put Hayward and Cable on the map with the many things that he did, brought tourism to the area, kept it alive. And the Birkebeiner that first year. There were 35 of us that lined up on the line. And this year, the 48th race, there were about 12,000 skiers that skied in all the events. So he had a vision of it growing to be an amazing event. And although he didn't, live long enough to see this 12,000 skiers, we all think of him every year.
We got an email from a William Johnson who says, "Hi, Ernie, missed visiting you with you when you skied through the gravel pit at the Berkey this year." And William says, "Tell us about the spectacle of the earlier Berkeys with torch runs, flaming cauldrons, and opening ceremonies with national anthems in front of the Telemark Coliseum."
Oh, my. Yeah, the Coliseum was quite a place. We would finish our races there in front of the Coliseum. And the opening ceremonies, which were usually on Thursday, included a parade of nations, and all the nations that came from all over the world had a sign with their, just like the Olympics. But then all of the states also, so skiers could group up with their state and march into the Coliseum from outside. It was amazing. And there was always a torch lighting to open the games and music, and it was a festival atmosphere that has carried over to the American Birkbeiner Foundation that keeps that energy and that spirit alive. The foundation and the staff just does an amazing job keeping this going.
Ernie, I got to ask you something. I'm thinking it's on a lot of people's minds. What is your training/exercise routine to keep you doing this year after year?
Well, I have two more to go to reach 50. And this year, I skied my race on Wednesday during the open track in absolutely perfect conditions. It was an amazing day. And so on Thursday, my grandson skied in the barn Berkey, and I was there with him. And, I'm on skis the next day. My training for next year has started already.
Wow.
It starts the next. I skied not a lot. Some people are still out looking for snow to ski. That's not me. I just stay active. I ride my bike. I hike. I'm always doing something outside. The fresh air and the sunshine is an amazing healer, gives us strength. And I believe it got me through COVID, as well as all the vaccines and everything else. The masks. I followed that religiously. I didn't take any chances, because I can't afford to get sick. But I believe that the fresh air and the sunshine played a huge part in that, just being outside and being active.
Ernie, I'll let you get back to training. Thanks so much for joining us today.
I enjoyed it, and thank you again for inviting me, and thank all the listeners.
That's Ernie St. Germain, who has skied the American Birkbeiner every single event since it was founded back in 1973. Right now it's time for Wisconsin Life. Here's producer Maureen McCollum with a look into how Wisconsin became the Badger State.
We recently received a listener question in the Wisconsin mailbag. Michael from Dane County asked, "Why is the Badger Wisconsin state animal?" WPR's John K. Wilson went digging to find out more.
Wisconsin is the Badger State. It's on the flag, it's the mascot of the state's biggest university, and back in 1957, lawmakers put the badger into state law as Wisconsin's official animal. But why? Badgers live in plenty of states, and they're pretty rare here. It's not like you see them running around willy-nilly like squirrels. To get some answers, I figured why not start by going straight to the source. Bucky, pretty common name for badgers, I guess, is the resident education badger at Henry Vilas Zoo in Madison. He goes on field trips and teaches kids about nature, so maybe he'd have something to tell me. On a recent morning, I talked with him in his enclosure while he was eating a hard-boiled egg. Hi, Bucky. John K. Wilson with WPR. Can I ask you a few questions? Do you know why the badger is Wisconsin's state animal? Any idea why you're on the state flag? I've seen this type before. Cute, but not a talker. Clearly, I needed someone with some more specialized knowledge.
My name is Jim Leary, and I'm a retired faculty at UW-Madison in Folklore and Scandinavian Studies.
Leary studies the history and culture of Midwestern people. He said the whole Wisconsin badger thing comes down to
lead mining in the late 1820s and into the 1830s and beyond in the southwest part of the state.
Yeah, lead mining.
In lead mining, there were little holes that people started to dig in and sometimes abandon, and they were called, sometimes called badger holes. But the prevailing story is that the early settlers actually lived in these holes, and that's where the name came from.
Turns out, though, that probably never happened. Leary says historians can't find any reliable evidence that miners actually lived in their badger holes. But either way, the name stuck. So, to boil it down, the badger is Wisconsin's state animal because 200 years ago, people here went digging for lead, and actual badgers also dig holes?
He is a great digger. He's got those really long front claws that are fantastic at digging burrows really quickly.
Back at the zoo, curator Jess Thompson had plenty of other good facts about real badgers like Bucky and his cousins in the wild.
There are a couple different types of badgers. There are badgers that live in Europe, European badgers. There's obviously the honey badger that many people know about in Africa. And there are some badgers that live in Asia. And most of those species are much more social. But our North American badgers are really solitary.
Thompson says badgers are ferocious hunters.
They also have jaws that are really hard to dislocate because of the way that they're attached in their skull. So because of that, they're able to attach really firmly onto their prey.
But aside from hunting prowess and a shared history of digging, is there something about badgers that makes them a good symbol for Wisconsin?
Definitely. Yeah, these guys are so resourceful, and they're known for being tough and being able to make it through a lot of different circumstances, so a lot of great qualities.
John K. Wilson is a digital editor at WPR and is the co-host of the WPR Politics Podcast. And this story came to us from a listener question as part of the Wisconsin Project. Submit your question and we might answer it in a future Wisconsin Life segment. Go to WPR.org/Wisconsin. Wisconsin Life is a co-production of Wisconsin Public Radio and Wisconsin Public Television in partnership with the Wisconsin Humanities Council. Additional support comes from Lowell and Mary Peterson of Appleton. Find more Wisconsin Life at wisconsinlife.org and on Facebook. I'm Maureen McCollum.
Coming up, bankruptcies hit new lows in 2021. We'll find out why and if that might last. That's next here on Central Time. It's Central Time. I'm Rob Verrett. Both individual and commercial bankruptcies in the United States were down in 2021. According to industry data from the company Epic Bankruptcy, the number of filings fell to their lowest numbers in at least the last 15 years, in spite of the pandemic. We're looking at why that might have been, what it means for the economy. Mary Eschelbach-Hansen is with us, professor of economics at American University, co-author of the book Bankrupt in America, A History of Debtors, Their Creditors, and the Law in the 20th Century. Mary, welcome to Central Time.
Hi, thanks for having me.
What do you think might have been driving this decline in bankruptcy filings last year?
Right. So most of us who study and watch bankruptcy were not terribly surprised by the decline in bankruptcy last year, because most people go to court because somebody's trying to collect money from them. And the most important somebody's out there are mortgage holders, right? So banks who have your mortgage, you're not paying, they try and collect by foreclosing. But most places, and in fact, the federal government for a while had a mortgage foreclosure moratorium during the pandemic. So banks couldn't go out and try and force people to pay. And so people didn't go to court.
Are we going to have, so I like this as good economic news for last year, but does that mean we're going to be playing catch up as those foreclosures that might have happened last year happen maybe this year instead?
So that's a good question. Certainly collections have resumed in most places, and that will increase bankruptcy rates somewhat. But there are two things to think about. One is all that stimulus money that came out of the federal government last year, right? The stimulus helped keep GDP from tanking for sure. It didn't have so much a direct short-term effect on bankruptcies because bankruptcies are driven by collections, but the stimulus may have a good effect going forward. And that's because during the pandemic, partly because of the stimulus, people took out fewer new loans, they built up less debt, and they saved more. In fact, during the pandemic, the savings rate was twice as high as sort of the average before the pandemic. So the drawdown of debt and the extra savings should keep the number of filings lower than you might think. I won't say they're going to be low, but lower than you might think.
Now, the mortgage thing, I think of mostly for individuals. I know businesses hold mortgages too, I suppose, and that individual stimulus might have been helping individual people save that money. How about the business side of things? Why are we seeing fewer businesses filing for bankruptcy last year?
Right. So, of course, a big chunk of the pandemic went to businesses to keep them afloat during the pandemic, right? It wasn't just the stimulus checks you and I got, but also businesses got those loans from the SBA and other agencies. And so that kept them afloat for the most part. But actually, the biggest difference, both during the pandemic and all the time, is that when businesses close, they're not as likely to leave a whole big pile of unpaid debt hanging around. So they don't go bankrupt. Bankrupt and closing are not the same thing, right? So lots of businesses closed over the pandemic for sure. But my guess would be that most of them did not have these big piles of debt.
Right. And that's an important distinction. I think a lot of times I hear bankrupt and I think, oh, that's disastrous for that individual, certainly, or for that business. Sometimes it can be a tool to allow, and I'm thinking especially of businesses here, a tool to allow a business to succeed in the future. Can you talk about that side of business bankruptcy a little?
So that's true, actually, for both individual people and for businesses. So the whole impetus of having a standing bankruptcy law in the United States was to keep the economy moving, to keep people moving. And in the 30s, especially the 1930s, there came to be a general understanding, both in Congress and in the courts and among people, that the point of bankruptcy was to provide a fresh start to people who had, for no like reasons that were their own fault, found it unable to pay their debt, right? So we call that a fresh start, right? The fresh start is a really central idea and has been for the last century. It lets people pick up and move on. So there are lots of famous cases. Ford went bankrupt before he made it rich, right? Lots of other folks like that. And from the perspective of an individual person or an individual entrepreneur, the ability to wipe out that debt and start fresh has been a big part of the story.
One other part of the story I wanted to bring up is medical debt. I've looked at different studies that assign a widely varying portion of personal bankruptcies to medical debt. How big a role do you see that playing? How has that changed over the years?
Right. That is so hard to estimate, which is why you see such a range. Even in the academic literature, there's not a lot of agreement. But it helps to think about what most bankruptcies are caused by, right? So most bankruptcies are caused by a bad thing that happens to you, right? And one of those bad things is getting sick, right? One of those bad things could be becoming unemployed, either because your plant closed or sometimes because we're in a recession and unemployment is increasing generally. But in the US, it's really hard to disentangle those, why people have medical debt, right? Because if you get sick, you're going to have medical debt, and then you might not be able to work, so you don't have any income to pay for it. Or if you become unemployed, you're much less likely to be insured, and then you might build up medical debt that you wouldn't have otherwise built up. And also you don't have a job, right? So it's very difficult to disentangle medical debt from any other causes of debt or of bankruptcy in general. That makes sense?
Yeah. Just in our last few moments, Mary, what are you watching for? You said it might not be as bad as a huge rebound in bankruptcy. What are the main things you're watching for just in our last half minute or so?
Yeah, sure. So the big trend long before the pandemic actually was declining bankruptcies. And the big reason for that is that the big bankruptcy reform in 2005 made it much more expensive for people to file. And so less people file. I'm curious to see if Congress comes back to the question of whether the current bankruptcy law is well structured.
Mary, we'll leave it there. Thanks again for joining us.
Happy to be here.
Mary Eschelbach-Hansen is a professor of economics at American University, co-author of the book Bankrupt in America, A History of Debtors, Their Creditors, and the Law in the 20th Century. She joins us for a look at last year's drop in bankruptcy filings for businesses and individuals. Coming up tomorrow on Central Time, the U.S. Supreme Court rejected Wisconsin's election maps for the state legislature. We'll find out why and what happens next in an election year. And seen any good movies lately? The Oscars are around the corner. A film expert joins the show. You could share your favorites as well. That and more coming up tomorrow here on Central Time. Coming up next, it's news from NPR and Wisconsin Public Radio. Then an economist who's a data scientist tells us how our good ideas can change the world and what pitfalls we need to avoid in order to make them work on a larger scale. I'm Rob Ferret. This is Central Time here on the Ideas Network. Central Time, I'm Rob Ferret. You're with us here on the Ideas Network. Coming up, we look at the highlights from the past 2.5 days of hearings for Supreme Court nominee Ketanji Brown Jackson. First, for a good idea to take root, grow, and have a big impact, it needs more than luck. It needs to be able to scale, to be used in a wide variety of situations and circumstances. Our guest says that's easier said than done, but there are lots of strategies to use and mistakes to avoid to make sure that our great concept, our solution to a problem, makes it from a small platform to a bigger one to maybe a world-changing one. And he says with the careful use of data, we can make a big difference in a business, in a community, even around the world. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Have you ever tried to start a business or grow a business or maybe a community event or a public service? What have you encountered as you tried to scale it up? What kind of successes? What kind of problems did you run into? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234 or email ideas@wpr.org. Wisconsin's own John A. List is the Kenneth C. Griffin Distinguished Service Professor in Economics at the University of Chicago. He's a research associate at the National Bureau of Economic Research. John received his bachelor's degree from UW Stevens Point. His new book is called The Voltage Effect: How to Make Good Ideas Great and Great Ideas Scale. John, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Hey, thanks for having me, Rob.
That concept of scale, so important to your book. Can you give us a little more of a definition of what we mean when we talk about scaling our ideas?
No, absolutely. So I want you to start by thinking about a petri dish or an initial experiment or exploration in a city. And if you find something great in that initial study, scaling is about, can it survive growth and go to other cities or other towns or other communities and have the exact same level of impact?
And the voltage effect, that's what you use to kind of define, like, does it keep up that energy? Does it keep up that success in that initial round in the petri dish or the school or the business, whatever it might be? What do we mean by voltage?
Exactly. So some of the listeners might be confused, but I want you to think about voltage as a simple question. Does what happens in the small also happen in the large? So if you have a great effect or big impact in the small, should you expect that to happen also in the large? And I'm here to tell you that it won't. There will be a voltage effect. Now, whether it's a voltage drop or a voltage gain depends on the features of your idea.
You give lots of specific examples from your own work with businesses, governments, schools, and more. I want to tackle one of them. You worked with the car company Chrysler when they were having a tough time for a while on an employee health program aimed at saving money at the company, an initially promising result. Can you talk us through that story?
Sure. That's a great story to start with. So the CEO was named Tom Lasorda. And I don't want you to think about the baseball manager from the LA Dodgers, Tom. That was not a typo, Rob. A real guy named Tom Lasorda. He's from Germany. And he had a handlebar mustache. And he and the exec team flew down to the University of Chicago to talk to me and some colleagues. And they wanted to talk to us about problems that they had at Chrysler. And one of the problems that Tom pointed out was he felt they had an overweight or an obesity problem amongst their line workers. And he thought that that obesity problem led to absenteeism and presenteeism. So some of you may never have heard of presenteeism. What that means is you're actually physically on the job, but you're not very productive. So what we did is we put together a weight loss program that we tried in Dearborn, in the Dearborn manufacturing plant, and it looked great. And the initial results showed that within 6 months, we had a lot of these line employees, a lot of these manufacturing employees losing weight. So Tom said, let's scale it to all of the plants immediately. And we said, whoa. Let's take another look and let's try it again. Let's try to replicate it, not only in the Dearborn plant, but let's try it in two new plants. And what we found is a big no result in all three of those plants. And what that told us is the initial insight was just a false positive. It was like when you take a COVID test and it says you're COVID positive, but you're actually negative. And that's what these results showed us. So we went back to the lab and produced something that actually did have voltage for him.
That illustrates one of what you describe as five pratfalls, five mistakes that people run across when they scale it up. Could you talk about the more general case here of that initial promising result that maybe was just a fluke?
Yeah. No, you're exactly right. So the story that I lead off the book with is actually Nancy Reagan and the DARE program. And in the DARE program, I was sitting in Sun Prairie High School. So that's where I went to high school. And a DARE program representative came in. And for all of you who don't remember or don't know what DARE is, it was a program where people would come in and say, just say no to drugs. And it was a social inoculation program. It was an information program. So these officials came in and they told us all about the bad reasons for, you know, why we shouldn't use drugs, et cetera, et cetera. So I looked at my teacher and I said, look, I don't use drugs, but I have a lot of friends who do. And there's no way this is going to work. In fact, if anything, Rob, I told him, it's going to be the opposite. This might cause me to dabble a little bit. And, you know, he said, well, John, you might be right, but they have data. And I looked into those data. He was right. They had data from Honolulu, and it was a big experiment. It had like 1,777 kids, but it was just a false positive. It was an error. And people don't really understand this, but when we do science, it's called the false positive rate. And in the best case scenario, that rate is still 5%. So 5% of the things we learn scientifically just by default are false positives. There's just no voltage there even though the data are lying and telling us that there is voltage.
We're talking to John List, Sun Prairie High School graduate and UW-Stevens Point graduate, now economics professor at the University of Chicago. His new book is called The Voltage Effect, How to Make Good Ideas Great and Great Ideas Scale. John, if somebody out there is thinking, hey, I've got this successful local business and I want to franchise it or go statewide or nationwide, or I've got a solution to a school problem that could be useful in other schools around the state, how would you recommend they start figuring out how to scale that up?
Yeah, that's a great question. Thanks, Rob. So the way I think about it is, before I started working in this area, it was an area of art. And what I mean by that, it was move fast and break things, or fake it till you make it. You know, these are famous Silicon Valley phrases, but it's really thinking about the science of scaling is an art. Now, what I'm adding here is real scientific insights. So the first half of the book basically says, if you have an idea, these are the five areas that you should test out your idea to make sure that it has the oomph that you believe it has. So for example, I talk about the slice of the pie that you're able to generate with your idea. I talk about, well, was your initial success due to an unscalable ingredient? Now here I talk about restaurants. Mm-hmm. A lot of restaurants try to scale, but if the initial success is due to the chef, then I'm here to tell you that it won't scale, because unique humans don't scale. And so there are just features like those two, and we also have spillovers and the supply side, that I basically give you a checklist that anyone, whether it's a person with an idea that might affect one person or a billion people, it's a scientific checklist that you should go through to figure out how scalable is my idea. And if it has features that you don't like, you then go back to the lab and change it around a little bit and put forward the idea that has a better chance to scale, should you be interested in scaling.
We're talking to John List, economics professor at the University of Chicago. His new book is called The Voltage Effect, How to Make Good Ideas Great and Great Ideas Scale. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Have you been at a workplace where a great new idea came along, maybe from elsewhere in your business or organization, school, whatever it might be, and then it fell flat when you tried to put it into practice? Have you tried to embiggen your own business or other idea at some point in your life? What worked? What didn't? What questions do you have for our guest? Call in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. You can also email ideas@wpr.org. We'll continue the conversation coming up here on Central Time. You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network. I'm Rob Verrett. We're picking up our conversation with John List, economics professor at the University of Chicago. He was recently back speaking at his alma mater, UW-Stevens Point. We're picking up our conversation about his new book, The Voltage Effect, How to Make Good Ideas Great and Great Ideas Scale. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Have you had an experience trying to take an idea, a business model, a training, you name it, and trying to make it bigger, bring it to more places? How did it work? What were the obstacles? Call 800-642-1234. Let's bring on a caller now. Nate is with us in Madison. Nate, hi.
Thank you very much. I happen to be a graduate of University of Wisconsin, Stevens Point also. Right. So good to hear you. Here's my issue. I'm an educator, and so I am very interested in upscaling a strategy that's been developed by people from across the state of Wisconsin, the rural areas. And the focus of the strategy is on about three key elements that we're trying to teach and implement with groups on a countywide type basis across the state of Wisconsin. And we've got a handbook, we've got a summary of the handbook, and we're planning to do a video orientation What can you do? What can you offer me as suggestions how we might scale this up?
Interesting, Nate. Thanks. Nice concrete example there. John, what would you suggest for Nate?
No, I like it. First of all, Nate, congratulations on being a fellow pointer. It's always wonderful to hear from my brethren. It's obviously a great university, and I just visited there about 2 or 3 weeks ago. So I can tell you that things at Point are going great, and I'm really excited about the new leadership there. So yeah, that's a good question. I'm also working in education, and I started a pre-K school some years ago, and the elements that we found the hardest in terms of trying to scale in the area of education was, on the one hand, getting the attention of people who we wanted to send the message to. So in the book, this is chapter 2 about know your audience and understand how to get the attention of your audience. So I suspect that you have that as part of your problem, that you have something great to give, but they're not always in receipt or willing to receive it readily. And in that world, we've thought about different incentives to get people interested in our product, in our educational product, which we're giving away for free. But so you might say, well, wait a second, it's free. Why aren't they taking it up? Well, people are busy and there's an opportunity cost of time. So I think the first thing that you have to cross is understanding how to get the attention of your audience and to get their compliance and actually reading and listening to your materials. And the second one has to do with your delivery mechanism. So what we found is, in Chicago Heights, where I started a pre-K school, we needed good teachers, and the teachers needed to be a certain level of quality. The problem is, I only had to hire 30 teachers, but if we want to really scale it up, we knew we had to hire 30,000 teachers. And it's hard to hire 30,000 good teachers. It was easy to hire 30. So you might also have to think about the delivery mechanism and to make sure that the quality maintains as you scale. I like where you're going with the videos, because something that always scales well is technology. But technology doesn't always substitute well for humans. And in that case, you have to have the correct humans actually delivering it to make sure that people are learning what you want them to learn. So I think those are two of the biggest hurdles that you're going to have to overcome, Nate. But thanks for your question.
Nate, thanks for calling in at 800-642-1234. Okay, let me test myself, John, and see if I've learned what you want me to learn. Would one possibility for Nate be to say, if they're hoping to get this in every county in Wisconsin, maybe pick one new county, maybe different than the one they're working in now, see if those ideas that worked in County A work in County B before trying to drop this thing everywhere?
Absolutely. You are a very quick learner.
Boom.
So Rob, that's right. So the idea here is, instead of going full blown right away with everything you have, why not try it out in a pilot? This is what we do. I used to be the chief economist at Lyft, and before that, Uber. We would choose one market and try out a few different things. And we would see if, you know, one way to attract people's attention might be a certain type of advertisement or a gift card or something, and then try out another way. And then once you figure out what works, then it's a lot easier to scale it across different counties in Wisconsin. And so, Rob, thank you very much. You're exactly right. That would be the approach, that the scientific approach that you would want to take to get the news out and attract attention.
We're talking to John List, economist, about his new book, The Voltage Effect, How to Make Good Ideas Great and Great Ideas Scale. One thing that struck me, John, especially in the later chapters of your book, is when you're going from something small to something big, that workplace culture that might have worked well, or you might have been able to get over the rough points in a small operation, can really start to fall apart when you go big. How do you translate workplace culture from small to big?
Yeah, Rob, that's a great question. So in chapter 9, I talk about scaling culture. So that's the title of that chapter. And you're exactly right. One kind of management style that will work when you go from one or two employees up to 50 or 100 might be altogether different than the management style and the approach you need when you go from 100 to 10,000 or 10,000 to 200,000. And that really is about, in the very beginning, how you recruit your workers, how you recruit your employees, how you generate an inclusive and diverse environment that has equal pay for equal performance, and how that then maps into an environment of collegiality rather than, I've been in a lot of places where it's really misguided meritocracy. And meritocracy is great at its roots, but if it's misguided and it turns into a kleptocracy, then we're in trouble. And that's what I see a lot of organizations actually evolve into. But I think in the very beginning, you can lay the seeds for an inclusive and a collaborative environment, because in every study after study after study, what you find is the import of diversity. And what I mean about that is diversity of thought. So I want people on a team who come at a problem from very different perspectives. And in many cases, that diversity of thought leads to a lot more innovation, a lot more exploration, a lot more, we're just getting the job done at the most efficient possible way. And that ends up leading to a culture that can scale.
That makes me think, John, if I have an idea that I think is really good, I want to root for this idea, right? And I want everybody to agree with me, and that can get me into trouble. How can I overcome my, and I think most people's inbuilt defensiveness, and make sure I've got some, you know, good naysayers around me?
No, that's an excellent, excellent question. So look, we have an idea that's our baby, and we take offense when people tell us it's a dumb idea. And when they bring data to us, we say, that data, that's wrong. Here's the right data over here. It's called confirmation bias in psychology. When we have a baby or we have an idea that we're trying to expand and we really believe in, we look for evidence that supports our thoughts and our baby. And that's exactly what you do not want to surround yourself with. I totally get the person in the room who's constantly your critic. That can be too much at points, but you do need a rational person to say, look, let's kick the tires and I'm going to be the devil's advocate for this idea. And I want to give some reasons why it won't scale. This is what I call a scaling unit within organizations. I want them to think scientifically, and I want them to be the critic to say, well, let's look at it from a different perspective. Or, you know, that may have worked for those people, but will it work for these other people who we're going to try to sell into as well? And I think you always need a devil's advocate in the room, because they will keep you honest. And it's not that you're trying to be nefarious. It's simply that as humans, we have built-in biases. And these biases are very, very difficult to overcome. So in many cases, you need an external force to try to allow you and make you overcome your own biases.
John, we'll leave it there. Thanks so much for joining us today. Appreciate it.
Oh, thanks so much for having me. And it's always, always wonderful to support public radio. Rob, you're doing a great thing, so keep it going, okay?
Thank you so much. That's John List, the Kenneth C. Griffin Distinguished Service Professor in Economics at the University of Chicago, a graduate, as we mentioned, of UW-Stevens Point. We talked to him today about his latest book. It's called The Voltage Effect, How to Make Good Ideas Great and Great Ideas Scale. Still time for you to share your thoughts. Have you helped make an idea, a business model, a training, whatever, scale up from local to big? What went right? What went wrong? You can email ideas@wpr.org. That's ideas@wpr.org. Coming up after the news, we'll check out the confirmation hearings for Supreme Court nominee Ketanji Brown Jackson. Another day of Senate Judiciary Committee hearings going on today. I'm Rob Ferret. You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network.